Hello and welcome to Monocle 24's The Urbanist, the show all about the cities we live in. I'm Andrew Tuck. On this week's program...
The music reflected this anti-violence message. They understood what crack was doing to the communities. They understood what police were doing to the communities. They also understood what gangs were doing to the communities. So they spoke out against this.
A snapshot of criminality in the US as New York enters the new year with a record low in the number of murders in the city. Then, a public transport tale of two cities... Athens' struggle with modernization and a victory over the test of time in London. Plus, we unpack some of the featured products in the Smart City stand at CES 2018. That's all coming up in the next 30 minutes right here on The Urbanist with me, Andrew Tuck. And we're going to start today's programme in Athens. This week, the Transport and Digital Policy Ministries announced plans for the installation of Wi-Fi across the city's public transportation. But our own Daphne Karnesis warns that we should take the news with a pinch of salt, reminding us of the other issues that should really be at the top of the list.
Every Greek government promises free Wi-Fi on public transport and it doesn't deliver. It's something that we first heard in 2011 by the then transport minister. It was initially hoped it would launch within the year, but by 2012, the only thing that had actually happened was the competition as to who would be the service provider. There were some trials done. I think 7 stations introduced it, but then they shortly dropped. It is something that's really needed. 4G and 3G is actually really expensive in Greece, so it would be a godsend to have free Wi-Fi and public transport. But the transport minister now is drafting plans for the installation of this Wi-Fi on buses, trolleys, trams serving the Athens area. It would be installed on, I believe, around 2,030 vehicles. Expected to be completed by 2018, so we'll just have to wait and see. As I said, these, they're still draft plans. I think any investment right now in infrastructure and transport in Greece is very welcome. One thing you need to know about Greece compared to cities like London is that everybody gets around by car. Few people use public transport. I mean, we do see it more and more now, but it's all down to do with the way that Athens developed as a city and the infrastructure developed as a city historically. After the Second World War, there was no proper urban planning, so it was a little bit of an afterthought. What was really promoted was cars. It was the new big thing in post-war Athens. Everybody had to get one. There are theories that this might have been a push from American auto lobbies who wanted to sort of push their agenda. Of course, Greece was very heavily reliant on the Americans after the war through the aid they were receiving from the Marshall Plan, for example. Little thought was given to things like trains, the metro system, transport networks. And in Athens, it's only been around for 13 years. It wasn't until the Olympics in 2014 that the undergrounds, the metro there, started being built, and it's still a very small network. And one of the challenges, I think, is the large number of ancient artefacts that people still come across in Athens when they're digging to create these projects is, of course, the regulations that exist about not being able to tamper with the areas where you find ancient artefacts. And one of the nice things that they've done is there are a few stations in the centre of Athens where, even though they've found artefacts, they've preserved them, they've encased them behind glass, so in the station, as you're, you know, waiting for the next train to pass, you can see these ancient statues behind you. Before we get to the Wi-Fi issue, there are other issues that are perhaps more basic that need to be solved first. For example, fare evasion, which we do see a lot. Right now, we still have paper tickets in the Athens metro, so anybody can walk in. There's no barriers that they have to pass. The only way you can get caught is if a train inspector actually checks your ticket. So we are seeing a lot of fare evasion. It's in part due to, you know, big pay cuts, tax hikes, / pensions that we're seeing that are fueling this fare evasion. People just saying, no, I'm not paying a cent more. It's very important to fix this issue first, and we are seeing already a lot of backlash, even to this small step of progress. But I do think the Wi-Fi would be amazing if it does happen. I know certainly I would love to be able to get around and be connected, be able to check my emails, be able to, as I said, 4G is quite expensive in Greece, so I think it would really solve a lot of issues for people.
That was Monocle's Daphne Karnizis with her take on her home city's public transport. Now we're going to turn our gaze to the United States, where New York City recorded the lowest number of homicides in the modern era last year. The figures are down by about 12.5%. In 2016, there were 335 murders in the city, and that was down to just 290 last year. And this drop in crime was more generalised too, with fewer shootings reported as well. But while New York has reasons to cheer, other US cities have seen their numbers rise instead. To understand more about criminality, race and justice in the American city, I spoke to Brenton Mock, who's a staff writer at CityLab.
I don't think anyone knows for sure. I think that there are a lot of theories going around. One, it can never be discounted, the impact that mass incarceration has had, particularly in cities like New York City, and specifically in communities of color, Black, Latino, Caribbean neighborhoods in New York City. Mass incarceration has been utterly devastating to those communities. And so I think that that's definitely one theory that's going around. The other theory is about policing itself, how policing has gotten smarter. And so there's definitely theories out there that the enlarging arrest rate and also the expansion of the New York Police Department in general has had some kind of impact on the drop in the crime rate.
Now, Brenton, you've written about this topic in great depth. And one of the pieces you wrote just before the end of 2017 tried to look at these numbers and analyze them a little bit. Reading your piece, what's striking is, you know, that first of all, you can cut the numbers various ways depending where you start as your base and whether you include, you know, big metropolitan outlying districts as well as the city core. But just looking at the numbers, you were talking there about the impact, particularly within Black communities. And another story that had a lot of impact last year was what was going on in Chicago. And mistakenly, I would have imagined that the murder rate there and the violent crime rate was in the ascendant. But actually, you say that there has been a fall in Chicago. Is that just the headlines were very grabby without us looking at the numbers very carefully?
There was definitely a dip in the homicide rate and the violent crime rate in Chicago between this year and last year. There was a 12% decrease in murder in Chicago. That's not an insignificant number. That said, you know, Chicago is still near the top of the list in terms of major cities and murder rates. There were 765 murders in 2016. That dropped to 675 in 2017. It's good that they had a 12% drop, but that's still really high, you know, especially compared to basically every other city in the United States except for Baltimore.
Now, another city you put the spotlight on just in that same tone is Washington, D.C., where there was a 23% plus drop in the homicide rate. So again, I don't want to get too caught up in just running through numbers, but as you look at this patchwork of cities, is it just policing? Is it just whether they're targeting particular communities? Because within the same state, you give, again, some numbers in Texas. You have cities where the murder rate is climbing and where the murder rate is falling. When you went through all these numbers, did you begin to think you could see the underlying causes in the various metropolises?
I think it's really hard to tease out the underlying causes, especially when you compare cities of different regions. I mean, the reason why crime fell in certain cities in Texas would not be the same as why crime fell in certain cities in New York. But we can say this, violent crime has been falling overall in major U.S. cities over the last 20 to 30 years. What we've also seen, if we just take the last 8 to 10 years, we've seen the unemployment rate drop considerably. So if we want to look at why violent crime has dropped over the last decade, we would be remiss not to mention the fact that unemployment is down, which we would presume you have more people participating in the workforce. And so the economic situation for many families in these major cities have improved. I think you also look, when you look at these major cities that did have problems with violent crime in the 80s and the early 90s, those would be the same cities that received a tremendous amount of resources from the federal government, sometimes from philanthropy, to kind of help them modernize, to kind of smarten up their strategies around how they would deal with crime, who specifically they would target, how that would be dealt with. Also, when you look at the last few years, you can look at just reforms in the criminal justice system in general, where a lot of people who were under the old regime, you know, they were arrested for a certain crime, they were incarcerated, and that was the end of the story. Over the last few years, because of criminal justice reforms, people are arrested, and there are services available within the criminal justice system that may divert them away from incarceration and might actually divert them to certain programs that could help them work training skills, mental health treatment, medical treatment, therapy, any kind of resources that might help these people get back on their feet. So that definitely cannot be ruled out. Also, I think culturally, there's a lot that has changed. You know, when you look at New York City, you obviously, I mean, you have to look at hip hop music and hip hop culture, which is usually attributed as a cause for violence. But when you look in the late 80s, early 90s of the hip hop movement, there was a strong anti-violence theme through a lot of the music during that time. There was an actual movement called the Stop the Violence Movement, which was led by KRS-One and Boogie Down Productions. That movement was signed on to by pretty much every major rapper that you can think of, particularly around New York City. And the music reflected this anti-violence message. They understood what crack was doing to the communities. They understood what police were doing to the communities. They also understood what gangs were doing to the communities. So they spoke out against this. And so with that movement, I think you start to see the drop in crime, which starts in the mid-90s. You can kind of see that being almost a reaction to what was happening culturally in a lot of these communities.
A pretty amazing insight. And it makes me wonder, when you, again, look at the headlines over the past kind of 18 months, you know, we had Donald Trump saying that if Chicago didn't get its act together with violent crime, he would be sending in the troops. We've seen many US politicians on the right read these numbers in a way that they try to use to back up arguments that US cities are out of control and there is a crime wave that needs to be stopped by them. But actually, is it more interesting then that many of the solutions have actually been successful because they've actually come from deep root thoughts and actions from within communities where maybe poverty and racism and all sorts of things have been evils that needed to be fought, and that's the gel that has changed the society more than anything like sending in a troop carrier?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, bringing it back to New York City, we can look specifically at a housing project, the Queensbridge Housing Projects, which is in the borough of Queens. This was the murder capital of the United States for pretty much all of the 80s and much of the early 90s. We're talking, you know, hundreds of murders in the Queensbridge Projects every year during that time period. 2 years ago, Queensbridge Projects went an entire year without one murder at all. Last year, there were two reported murders. So this is an area that went from having hundreds of murders a year to going an entire year recently without a murder at all and now being in the single digits. That was not because the federal government sent in the troops or, you know, or whatever it is that Donald Trump is alleging. There was no infusion of anything in there. That was literally a self-generated program by the community members who lived in the Queensbridge Projects, who put together their own mechanisms for how they can address and get in front of a violent situation before it happened. And I imagine that there are situations like that that played out in a lot of neighborhoods across New York City and also across Chicago and other cities experiencing that kind of violent crime. And it should be noted that even with Chicago, even with its high numbers right now, and they're really high, it's still nowhere near as high as even what murder rates looked like in Chicago in the 90s.
And Brenton, finally, you know, again, when you're not American, when you look at the US statistics, you know, in the 90s, when you were sitting in Europe or many Asian cities, you couldn't believe those numbers. Now, as they fall back again and again and again. Do you think that the murder rate in a US city might be the same as it one day as it is in a Stockholm or a Finland, where you're counting on two hands often the number of people who get murdered in a year?
I think the only way that that's going to happen is if the federal government really applies some better gun control mechanisms, where there is much more control over who gets guns, what kind of guns are available on the market, and also just social safety net issues, all, you know, being strengthened in the United States, all the kinds of things that you find in these other cities and countries in Europe where the murder rate is really low.
That was Brenton Mock, who's a staff writer at CityLab, speaking to me a little bit earlier. This week, London's Underground is celebrating its 155th anniversary. It might be hard these days to picture that inaugural trip on a steam train from Farringdon to Paddington in the new Metropolitan Railway. But Monocle's Carlotta Rabella was joined in the studio by the urbanism guru Kat Hanna to talk about the Tube's past, present and also its future, and how it has helped to shape London into the city that we know today.
You know, its impact was absolutely transformational. I think it's quite hard to overstate that, really. But I think what's remarkable is actually in quite a short amount of time, we made really good progress in terms of what we built, but also in adoption as well. You know, I think Londoners soon became very used to the idea of, you know, commuting via the Underground, and it gave the sense to both the dynamism of the city, of people commuting in for work, but also enabling actually London to grow to an extent outwards to the development of the suburbs that we saw in the 1930s as well. So it's been absolutely instrumental in determining both the shape of how London's grown, how it's grown economically, the type of built environment that the capital has as well. But yeah, I think it's massively important for how people orientate themselves around the city, which can be both really valuable. You know, a lot of people probably know their way better around the Tube than they do at street level. And that can sometimes be a bit disorientating as well. We sometimes see when we have, you know, the odd Tube strike, and people say, oh God, I didn't realise I could actually walk 10 minutes instead of doing this interchange. So it's actually, you know, quite interesting that that is how people will often orientate themselves around the city, especially perhaps if you're new to London or if it's not an area you know that well. Your position on the line and what line you're on is often, yeah, it's something that's kind of quite familiar and quite easy to get your head around, I think. It's a really interesting question about impact. You know, we talk about, for example, the commuter belt, but I think actually, yes, you know, we all talk about London. It is still, I think, to an extent, you know, a series of villages. And a lot of these locations, especially if you go out to the suburbs, you know, I don't think they would want to see themselves necessarily as a dormitory, but actually as a hub or a town or a village with their own identity in their own right. And I think that raises a really important question as we look at new development. How do we make sure we're not just building dormitories around a station, but somewhere that's a destination, that's a place that people want to actually be in, not just go to in the morning to leave to come into the centre of the city as well?
Just to think, going back to when the Tube first started, that idea that of getting people underground, you know, that's where you would go when you die. It was so difficult to change mentalities and get people to start to use a Tube. And these days, you can't even imagine your life in the city without it. But there is a very architectural and design element to it that is very important about making sure it's not just a place for you to just walk in every morning and at the end of the day, that actually brings something to the area.
You're right, and it's quite unique about London is often the value we've placed on our station architecture. You look at, you know, iconic architects like Charles Holden and their role in designing a lot of the suburban stations. And, you know, I think it's often because stations occupy this space kind of at the liminal level, somewhere between, you know, the above ground and going underground, where you realise when you're there, you know, there's probably as much of London underneath the street as there is above it. And I think that's something now we perhaps take for granted. But like you said, you know, initially, I think probably would have been really something that was quite transformational to the city. In terms of how we adapt these spaces, I think it's both a challenge and an opportunity for a lot of people, either, you know, their local station, either where they live or where they come to work. It's often part of that town centre. You know, it's very much bound up in the identity of place. So, you know, necessarily being able to adapt it to, for example, build residential accommodation around it, to add additional retail, that's got to be done really carefully and it's got to be done well. And I think what we're seeing is we are getting much better at doing that, at being quite imaginative at how we can turn stations into actually a destination. So if you look at what Transport for London are doing, where they're actually looking and saying, you know, we have a role now in commercial development that includes accommodation. You know, from an urban perspective, it makes sense to build houses in well-connected locations, where it's better connected than building above or around a station. But there are obviously a lot of challenges. You know, if you're someone like Transport for London, you are there to operate the transport, but you're also there to look at what land do we own? What could we do with this? How can we turn this into a really exciting place? And you said, you know, that's ready not just for 2018. I mean, I think TfL are looking further forward than that. We're looking 2030, 2040. So again, how do we make sure that these are places that can really last? That does have its limitations. You know, London is a city that's got both this Victorian infrastructure in many places. So even some of what you think might be more straightforward around additional escalators, step-free access, these things can be quite costly. So it is, again, about getting that balance between, you know, addressing the challenges of some of the older parts of the infrastructure, but looking, actually, where is that opportunity to make a really exciting new destination? You know, you only have to look at somewhere like King's Cross to see actually how transformational, both underground and above ground, that impact can be.
And now with the projects for Crossrail coming to life as well, it's an opportunity to rethink and do things as it works best for both us, the users and the citizens, and the train operators. So it's both about the practicality of a place, but also how it makes you feel in a place. And a lot of those challenges that with the younger stations that are quite old now, it's a new opportunity to rethink how to do things.
Yeah, absolutely. And even just, you know, if we look at actually how people move around the city changes. So something like, you know, Boris bikes, which we didn't necessarily have, you know, 20 years ago. So it then means, well, actually, what do we do if people are leaving the station and they're switching to another mode of transport, or if they leave the station and they're then getting a bus? How do we make that space easy to navigate, both for people that live in London or for tourists as well? How do we make sure people can disperse away from that station? This is one of the challenges in places like with Crossrail arriving, places like Tottenham Court Road, is you just have this sheer volume of people coming up into the street. And how do we make sure that when they arrive, you know, they know where they're going, they do so, you know, in a straightforward way. So there are these big challenges, both kind of practically, but like you said, also about how people experience that as well. And, you know, I think that's, again, where architecture is hugely important, both in terms of how you find your way, but also how you feel when you enter that space.
Do you think it helps understand the city, the way the tube is organised?
Yes and no. I mean, I think if we look, obviously, you know, the work of Beck in producing, you know, the simplified tube map, yes, it is incredibly helpful. I mean, I'm probably biased. I've lived in London most of my life. So to me, it's quite intuitive to use a tube map. It's always different when you go to another city and you're like, what on earth is going on here? And what I think was quite interesting, TfL put out some data recently that looked at how people navigate various interchanges. So if you were doing something, say, Oxford Street to King's Cross, a lot of the time people take really odd routes around the underground. They don't go the simplest way. They don't necessarily follow the map. They might be dedicated to using this one interchange because they've always used it. And even now, there's now a better way to do it. Or they could get off a stop earlier and walk. They're just quite stuck to this route, which is something that I imagine probably as a transport planner is both quite frustrating, but also somewhat, it's a little bit endearing about how human we can still be, about how we use these systems. Again, though, I think it can, again, sometimes be a bit disorienting as well. And that's in terms of understanding how this subterranean space mirrors what is above it as well. And that mirror isn't always the perfectly accurate reflection, especially in terms of distance. So again, this idea of can we actually walk between stations rather than doing it? And again, that's, I know, something that TfL are looking at is how do you encourage people to think about all those modes of transport as well? Because actually, the better people use the tube, for example, rather than using private cars, the better the street then comes for walking and cycling as well. So actually the decisions people make about how they move around London, not just using the tube, you know, is actually really very important to that feeling of how we experience the city.
Well, that was the urbanist Kat Hannah speaking to Monocle's Carlotta Rebello. And finally on this week's programme, we look back at the Consumer Electronics Show, which just wrapped up in Las Vegas. Smart cities was one of the hot topics at CES 2018, as major tech firms continue to come up with new innovations to bring urban living into the digital age. Our technology correspondent, David Phelan, was there and he gave Tom Edwards a breakdown of what he saw.
Panasonic, big electronics company, very noticeably opened their keynote press conference, not talking about the TVs or anything else, they got onto that, but by talking about smart cities, smart roads. They're working with the state of Colorado. They've made a big swathe of the I-90 highway smart so that there are sensors all along it. which at the very basic level means that there are signs that are connected signs that will appear at the side of the road saying there's congestion ahead. But increasingly, that information will be beamed into cars. They claim that they can, within a decade or so, they could achieve 80% fewer accidents and quadruple the amount of traffic on the highway at the same time. BMW has already developed a system where the cars can talk to traffic lights. So as you're getting towards a junction, it says this light is going red in 45 seconds. So you can tell whether you need to accelerate or slow down and chill for a minute. And those things, I think, are becoming much more mainstream.
Well, let's talk about some of the companies. Interesting hearing from Bosch, and I know that various higher-ups in their company were talking about cities without intelligence being unable to survive, apparently, which again you can imagine. And they paint this picture of cities just becoming ever more gridlocked, and
yes,
surprise surprise, their tech being the pathway out of that. What are some of the things Bosch have been talking about?
Yes, Climo is their monitoring system, which measures the air in the city in 12 different ways, and apparently this is done through an appliance that is much smaller than previous systems, much cheaper, and is able to analyse these things more effectively. And of course, that means not just in terms of the air for pedestrians, but that affects traffic levels, and that means you can analyse things in a different way. So according to Bosch, 67 hours annually in London is spent by drivers looking for a parking space. And that means, I'm not sure if that's per driver, but the point is one third of urban driving is taken up just with people trying to find parking spaces. So if you can introduce what they call community parking, so that when a car pulls into a space, the system knows that, and it sees a car driving around, it can tell you where the nearest parking spaces are. That obviously is a useful system. So it's not just relying on, as we all do now, thinking, oh, well, I know that place down there usually has a few more spaces.
Let's just rattle through another couple of items which sort of promise, particularly in that sort of cities context, a brighter future. Maybe literally in the case of the Wink Bar connected handlebars. Clever and perfect for the urban cyclist.
Yes, and they're connected in every way. First of all, they're connected very firmly by screws and everything to the bike itself, but they're also connected to the internet. They've got GPS in them, which means that if, like me with losing my car, you can't remember where you've left your bike, the app that inevitably comes with it will tell you. Similarly, if it gets stolen, then it immediately sends a message to your app and shows a little map of where the bike is going so that you might be able to get it back. It has a fitness tracker so that it knows how far you're going and tell you how many calories you're burning when you're cycling, or when the thief is cycling, I suppose. And it also has lights built into it, the brightness you refer to. They're bright at night, but during the day, when you've put in the destination on the iPhone or the smartphone app, it will flash to the right when you're to turn right, left when you're to turn left. So it gives you turn-by-turn navigation as well. So it's quite a compelling alternative to unconnected handlebars.
What if you were relying on public transport rather than your own pedal power or car? There's obviously lots of systems. We have the Oyster here in London, and there's lots of other fairly clever chip-based transport travel solutions.
Sure.
But MyBus M-ticketing appeared in Vegas, and that caught your eye too.
Yes, this is a good way of going back to, I don't know if anyone really thinks of QR codes as being an important part of our lives. We use them very, very occasionally, but they never took off in the way that barcodes are completely ubiquitous. However, they do have a use, because normally what you do is you need an Oyster card or you need a credit card to use the tube in London, as you say. But there are so many different apps and so many different systems that there is very little standardization. Now, MyBus M-ticketing means that you use a QR code which will be on the bus or on the train, and you simply hold your phone in front of it, and the camera, even on the iPhone, which didn't used to do this now, has a QR code reader built into the camera so it can automatically read that. And that data will be enough for the MyBus app. You still need that app, but it will work across different systems to charge you the correct fare.
That was Monocle's technology correspondent, David Phelan. He was speaking to Tom Edwards. And that's all we have for this week's episode of The Urbanist. The show was produced by Carlotta Ribello, and it was edited by David Stevens, Christy Evans and Cassie Galpin. To play you out of this episode of The Urbanist, here's St. Vincent with Digital Witness.
Thank you for listening, City Lovers.
Goodbye till you see.